For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sale, and this week, journalist Sabah Salman introduces us to Made Possible, a collection of stories that she hopes will change the public perception of people with learning disabilities. Sarah Waters talks to Robert Kirkwood about The Little Stranger, a novel in which she changed era and, for the first time, the gender of her protagonist. And children's author Caroline Lawrence, famous for her Roman mysteries, takes us to ancient Greece with her time travel diaries. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Sabah Salman is a social affairs journalist who writes regularly for The Guardian. She has spent the last year compiling and editing a book called Made Possible, a crowdfunded collection of essays on success written by high-functioning people with learning disabilities. By giving voice to these contributors, allowing them to tell their own stories in their own words, she hopes to change the narrative of how people with learning disabilities are seen by the general public and the mainstream media. It's a project very close to her heart. Sabah Salman, welcome to Read On.
Thank you so much, Red, for having me on. It's a pleasure.
You have a very personal reason for having written Made Possible, don't you?
Absolutely. So Made Possible is influenced by my younger sister, Rana, who has a learning disability. And when she was growing up, she was never asked that question that most kids get asked when they're younger, which is, what do you want to do in life? What do you want to do when you grow up? And it's really because society doesn't extend the concept of ambition and success and aspiration to people with learning disabilities. I wanted to write this book because it was a book I wanted to read, frankly. I could have done with this book when my sister and I were younger, because you never hear the words success and learning disability together. What Made Possible does is challenge those negative assumptions about learning disability. So, you know, we're not talking about vulnerable people who are pitied or patronized. But what it does is encourage people to say, look, by regarding people like Rana as second-class citizens, we're missing out on a huge amount, you know, people's contributions. We're all human. And this is a book about equality and inclusion, and the idea that, yeah, we all have a value. We can all be successful.
I think that's something that will chime with an awful lot of our listeners. As people who have lost our sight or been born with no sight, we've actually had to become very good problem solvers. And those of us who are lucky enough to work actually turn out to be quite an asset for those we work for. But too often, potential employers and those around us focus on the lack of sight rather than the potential.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it is exactly that same principle, that it's about society looks at what people can't do rather than what they can. And I think this is such a deeply ingrained attitude. And that is what we need to free ourselves from. And two things that I've seen, both as a sibling and as someone who writes and comments about these issues, is that even as a family member, you spend so long arguing for the right support for your relative. You fill out these forms, benefit forms, we've got welfare reform. And over the last few years, especially since austerity has hit, we're all being squeezed. And my family and I have had to really argue for the best support that we can get for my sister in order for her to live a great life, an ordinary life. And that often means ramping up what she can't do. So you spend your time filling out these absolutely dreadful forms all about, she needs this support, she can't do that. She must have this because she can't do this. And so you yourself, even though you know the potential of this person, you yourself get so focused on that negative, as you said, that the lack, the deficit essentially, that it's really hard to come away from that and go, oh, actually, there's a personality here, there's a potential here. So I think there's both of those things. I think within society and within employers, there is that very deeply ingrained negative attitude for which there appears to be very little incentive from government, despite years of all sorts of campaigns and nice slogans. But there's also that trickling down into families and people themselves, that it really does take a lot of determination to go, no, this is wrong. we all have, as I said, that value and that potential that needs to be unleashed and supported.
And you illustrate that very vividly by gathering the stories of eight very successful individuals, importantly, in their own words.
Absolutely. So the whole point of this book is that it's people's direct voices. And as well as wanting to produce this book because I wanted to share my sister's story and shatter those negative stereotypes, I also felt that as a journalist, when I've interviewed or collaborated work with people with learning disabilities, so often I'm bringing my own filter to those interviews and my word counts or my deadlines or trying to shoehorn someone into a case study. It just doesn't let their story breathe. And I think it's so much more powerful to have people tell their own stories, because human stories, that touches people, and to have that direct voice is so important. It's so powerful. And as you said, these eight people, I mean, they truly are remarkable. When I was working on the book, I was just constantly so amazed, even though with several of the contributors, I'd worked with them before, I'd come across their names through my journalism, but to actually sit with them and spend a lot of time hearing about what their dreams were and their challenges and how they've approached the barriers. It also across all these different fields. I mean, these are eight people working in art, in campaigning and sport, singing, acting, politics. It really runs the whole range of all of those things that you think about, as I said, when you're a kid. You look at different career options and these people are living that. They're doing it. And for me, their achievements and their success, it's remarkable, regardless of any support need they have.
Now, to give a couple of examples, you have the first British mayor who has a learning difficulty and a very highly successful actress.
So the mayor, first elected councillor, in fact, with a learning disability, and the first UK mayor, Gavin Harding, who's an absolutely incredible guy, he always wanted to go into politics. He's got a political family. And the amazing thing about Gavin is that the whole thing that drives him is representing everybody. He's just got this incredible drive to make things better in communities and also use his voice. Now he's got this platform to raise awareness about what's missing in terms of support for people with learning disabilities. And his story is incredible. He spent 10 years in a variety of ATUs, which are assessment and treatment units. And these are places that people with learning disabilities, autism and mental health issues are sent to essentially to help them find the right support. But more often than not, they're stuck there for years on end. And I think there's about 2,500 people still stuck in these places. And Gavin had a cycle of going in and out of these absolute hellholes. And he uses that experience to make sure that other people don't end up in these places. But yeah, he's an incredible politician. And Sarah Gordy, the actor, she's just so sparky and driven. And what drives her is the fact that she says, I'm a professional actress. I'm not professionally Down syndrome. And her chapter is all about the hard graft of acting. It's about the process of acting, the tricks of the trade, and the fun she has with her job. So it's not just a story about an actor with a learning disability. It's a story of an actor and an amazing woman. And just to give you flavour, her chapter's called Champagne, Snakes and Stealing Chips. So it's just very quirky, very fun and just, yeah, joyous, really.
And I think the thing that really struck me about all their stories is just how much of an individual effort it is, but how we rely on those around us, which goes for people whether they have a disability or not, but actually is something that I think is more difficult for those of us with disabilities sometimes to admit to, that we feel we have to fight the fight by ourselves, and mountains just don't get conquered single-handedly.
I think that actually is true across the board. I mean, one really interesting thing that happened while I was working on the book with Dan Pepper, who's an incredible multi-medal winning ex-Paralympian and elite athlete, he turned around to me when we were in discussion about the support that we need to get where we need to get to. And instead of answering my question about, well, what support did you have? He just said, well, what support did you have to get here? Mm. And that for me said it all, really, because I just didn't produce this book with these people from nowhere. I don't carry on my work as a journalist without any support. And I think we are, all of us, regardless of a disability, really, we underestimate and we don't talk enough. We don't acknowledge that we all need these support structures in place. Clearly, it's about your determination and your ambition and your focus and your drive. But then that has to be supported by people who know you, who trust you, who believe in you, as well as you believing in yourself, which is the starting point. And a lot of these essays, several of the contributors talk about how you have to be proud of yourself first. You have to have that self-belief. And that then is the trigger to ensuring that you get the right people around you. We all need to be better at acknowledging that. Not just those of us who need the support, but actually everyone around us. Success just doesn't appear as a perfectly packaged gem. It grows and it's organic and it requires a person at the centre to drive that, but to ensure that we all have the right people around us and it's tailored to each individual.
Well, yes. And what I loved about the 8 accounts is there's no sense of embarrassment there, which I think the non-disabled world transfers its embarrassment at not knowing how to deal with us onto us, which is why it either makes us into pitiable characters or amazing heroes. And it's not. It's just everyday life.
Absolutely. And these are such ingrained attitudes. And what I love about these essays, as the singer Lizzie Emma says in hers, is she's loud and proud. All of these chapters are so honest and authentic. This isn't misery lit. That's not what I'm saying. We're not moaning about the challenge, but we are saying, yeah, we've had huge challenges, but we're not taking this crap, essentially. And that's very powerful. And I think you're right that it is that transference from the non-disabled community about, oh, we're slightly awkward about this. We don't know how to deal with this. And I see it myself growing up with a sister who has a learning disability who is a little bit different. People's reactions, they can be anything from point blank ignoring her to talking to me instead because they're a bit awkward and embarrassed and not quite sure how to speak to someone who's a little bit different, to being quite negative or aggressive verbally. So I think you're right that those attitudes are not only terrible in themselves, but when they then seep into, for example, the 8 people in this book or my sister or other friends and family that I have with learning disabilities, that's even worse. It compounds the challenges that already exist.
And it's the repeated words that we get in the media or in lazy summations of what disability means. The words like suffering or actually just not knowing what a learning disability is. You remind us of that cringeworthy moment when Theresa May was asked a question by somebody with a learning disability just before the general election.
Oh, that's such a dreadful moment. It just says it all, really. Yes, so she was asked, what are you doing for people with learning disabilities, by someone who had a learning disability? And she said, oh, we're doing a lot of things for people with mental health issues. And this is not the first time I've heard this, that there is just such a huge level of ignorance and perhaps even willful ignorance about what a learning disability is. But what then makes it worse is, as you said, the language that surrounds it that we have in the media, things like someone suffering from Down syndrome, even the word someone was diagnosed. My sister is a person. She's not a series of diagnoses. She's not a medical condition. I mean, yes, she's a person with a learning disability, but that's exactly what she's a person first. She happens to have a learning disability. And the very lazy language that compounds these dreadful stereotypes is something that actually all 8 people in this book, and of course countless others, are really trying to blow out of the water.
Now, I had great hope when the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime was published some years ago, and it did start a debate about learning disabilities. And I wonder if things have really moved on much in the past decade, and suspect not.
Well, things have moved on. You mentioned the curious incident, which did a lot to raise awareness of autism and disability. But what happens is you have these spikes of interest, these one-off. We had, for example, the Paralympics. We hosted the Paralympics, which was amazing. And I know that a lot of people, myself included, just thought, wow, this is fantastic. This is going to change everything. We all had these high hopes. And actually, after the initial interest, it kind of fizzled out. And for me, there is a level of sadness about the fact that we have these spikes of interest and events, and it raises awareness, and you suddenly have a flurry of people talking about disability, writing about disability, have disabled people appearing on the news. You're someone with a learning disability. You never hear from people directly in the national news media, usually with a learning disability. So there is progress. But for me, it's the fact that there are these moments when there's an interest and then it tails off. And it's the pace of change that's slow. Certainly in the last decade, we've also had austerity. So every time you have something that's positive and someone speaking out and a level of press interest, you then underlying it, you just have this context where the rug is being pulled from underneath people's feet. So I'm not pessimistic, I'm pragmatic. And for me, there has been huge progress, certainly in terms of learning disability and how people have been treated. I mean, not just the last decade, but going back 40 years, people are no longer in institutions. There are more people living in communities, and the self-advocacy movement, people speaking up for themselves, is really growing. But it's just the pace of change.
And the story behind the book actually indicates that there is a grassroots support movement out there. This is a crowdfunded book, and it achieved its necessary target very quickly.
Yes, and that just shows the level of demand for something like this, because the reason I wanted to publish this book is because I wanted to read it myself, and it hadn't been done. And actually, the reason for crowdfunding it was two reasons. One was because mainstream publishers are, suffice it to say, not incredibly keen on learning disability. So this non-traditional method put me in direct contact through a crowdfunded publisher. I have to say, this wasn't a book that I just woke up one morning and thought, I'm going to launch something on a crowdfunding platform. There are many of them. But I went through Unbound, which is a crowdfunding publisher. So it meant that it connected me directly with people who were interested in the book. And to crowdfund it in 6 weeks does show the level of support. And it was crowdfunded by families of people with learning disabilities, support organisations, academics, people who have no link to learning disability but are interested in human rights, who are interested in equality and diversity. So there is also something to be said about how the book, in terms of how it was produced and that determination to get it out and having it as an independent thing, does reflect a lot of the messages in the book itself.
It's going to be reaching a print disabled audience through being recorded as a talking book by the RNIB Talking Book Studios.
I'm so delighted. I cannot tell you how happy I am that RNIB is producing this book. My whole thing, or everybody involved in this book, either because their names appear in it or they've helped to produce it through crowdfunding, all we want is for the book to reach as many people as possible. And unfortunately, given this is a crowdfunded book, so we did not have the budget to produce all sorts of different accessible versions. But that is certainly my hope, that everybody should read this book. This isn't just a book if you have an interest in learning disability. It's a book of great stories. It's a book about how you achieve what you want to achieve and what you need around you to make that happen. So I'm just absolutely delighted. I cannot wait for people to have access to it and to hear what they think, because that's important to me as well.
Father Sean. Sean Webster, MBE. I'm standing on my dad's doorstep. It's 20 years since he called me a retard. I haven't seen much of him since then. He told me I'd never work, never live on my own, never have a relationship. I'm here today holding the MBE I was awarded for services to people with learning disabilities. I came on the bus from the flats where I live alone. I've got an ex-girlfriend standing next to me for moral support. I haven't told my dad I'm coming.
Chris Dyer narrating Made Possible, stories of people with learning disabilities in their own words, written by my guest Sabah Salman.
Well, it really is a very uplifting book that's not full of extraordinary and impossible stories, but just stories of everyday success.
Oh, absolutely. My sister's story that I explore in the introduction to the book is exactly a story about everyday or ordinary success. Rana has not won an MBE. She hasn't trodden the boards at the National Theatre. She hasn't got a raft of sporting medals like some of the contributors later on in the book. But her success is growing her own independence. Her success, for example, is choosing her own Christmas presents for the family, which to most people, and I explain this in the book, that's such an ordinary moment. You go visit your parents, you take some gifts. But for Rana, the first time that she had gone, she'd moved to a residential college for people with special needs, and she had been going out shopping with a support worker. Now, she'd never done this before. So that first Christmas, about 15 years ago, where we all converged at my parents and Rana's gifts were there under the tree, and that was just such a landmark moment because it was the success that she'd had at building the confidence, making her choices, going shopping on her own, ignoring the money that she doesn't like handling, so she'd paid with a card. All of these things she was making and still continues to make great achievements in terms of independence. So that's her level of success, or her version of success is something she's defined herself. And one thing that the non-disabled community does is put its own expectations on people. Now, as I said, Rana hasn't made some of the, I suppose, the more orthodox
headline grabbing.
Yes, exactly. She hasn't. But for us, for her family and for her, it's incredible what she does. And she does every day. And as well, it's interesting that you picked up on these remarkable achievements and all these people that have done incredible things. You're first at this, the first at that, and awarded this and honorary that. But actually, for a lot of the contributors to this book, I'm thinking particularly of Sean Webster, for example, who's a human rights campaigner, who's travelled all over the world, he's got an MBE. And when he talks about his success, of course, he mentions all of that. But he actually says, you know, I'm really proud of being a granddad. I really wanted to live on my own. And one of the most lovely moments in his essay is when he talks about the first bus journey he took on his own to go down the road to the cinema. And it's a lovely story, and he gets there, and I won't spoil it, but the thing he goes to see, and he's terribly excited about it, great achievement, he doesn't enjoy the film in the end, but that's not the point. And so it's exactly that. It's just that we all should be able to define our own success, not have it defined for us. And we should all have the freedom to do that, regardless of any support need that we have.
Well, it really chimed with me. I have a quiet celebration every time I make it back into the house with the shopping without having walked into something or had to apologise to somebody just for using the pavement.
Exactly. It's all of those things. We, all of us, are not very good at acknowledging that actually that day that you had to reboot the computer, you thought you'd lost your work, you somehow salvaged it, or whatever it may be. Or, yeah, just defining your own success and actually being proud of it rather than worrying about what it is you haven't done, or other people, assuming other people will think less of you because you haven't achieved this extraordinary success.
Well, Sabah Salman, thank you very much for producing an extraordinary book, which I really do urge listeners to pick up in whatever form they find most accessible. The book is called Made Possible: Stories of Success by People with Learning Disabilities. And I hope you'll come back at the end of the show to share the books of your life.
Thank you so much, Red. I really enjoyed speaking to you.
Made Possible: Stories of Success by People with Learning Disabilities, in their own words, by Sabah Salman, is out now in print, ebook, and the talking book version is available from the RNIB library. And Sabah will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. Coming up later, we've got a treat for our younger listeners, as Caroline Lawrence explores ancient Greece in a brand new adventure series to rival her Roman mysteries. But first, as part of LGBTQ+ History Month, throughout February, we're highlighting the contribution of the LGBTQ+ community on society and literature. And here's Robert Kirkwood to introduce one of my favourite historical novelists.
Author Sarah Waters is known for novels such as Tipping the Velvet, Affinity, Fingersmith and The Night Watch, many of which have been adapted for stage and screen. All of her early novels contained lesbian themes, but when The Little Stranger entered the Talking Books library, I thought it'd be interesting to talk to Sarah, as it was both a change of era and a change in the gender of the main protagonist. Before we hear from Sarah, let's hear a clip narrated by Simon Vance.
I first saw Hundreds Hall when I was 10 years old. It was the summer after the war, and the Ayreses still had most of their money then, were still big people in the district. The event was an Empire Day fete. I stood with a line of other village children making a Boy Scout salute, while Mrs. Ayres and the Colonel went past us, handing out commemorative medals. Afterwards we sat to tea with our parents at long tables on what I suppose was the South Lawn. Mrs. Ayres would have been 24 or 25, her husband a few years older. Their little girl Susan would have been about 6. They must have made a very handsome family, but my memory of them is vague.
The Little Stranger is a kind of ghost story set in the 1940s. Most of the action takes place at a house called Hundreds Hall, which is a large country house that is in decline. It's kind of crumbling away, really. The novel is narrated to us by a country doctor, Dr. Faraday, who befriends the Ayreses, the family living at the house. And during his friendship with them, strange and increasingly frightening things start happening at the hall.
Is Hundreds Hall based on a real place?
It's not, no, not really. I did visit a lot of houses while I was writing the book, and obviously I tried to visit, you know, houses from the right period, so I was looking at Georgian houses, which are a favourite kind of house of mine anyway. And I think I just used little details from all sorts of places and brought them together for Hundreds, and, you know, other things that I invented that felt right for that house. So it's definitely, you know, alive for me. I've got a very strong visual image of it, but no, there's no way you can go and actually visit it.
This was your second book set in the 1940s after a few novels set in the Victorian era. So are you changing eras?
Well, I loved writing those first three novels with their Victorian setting. You know, I felt very at home in the 19th century, but I ended the last one feeling like I might be in danger of getting stuck in the 19th century. I knew that the longer I stayed there, the harder it might be to leave. So that seemed like a good point to try something new, and that's when I moved to the 1940s. But having finished that, I found I was still really interested in the post-war period. So then, yeah, I wrote The Little Stranger, and not going to go back to the 19th century just yet. I might go a little earlier, maybe into the sort of interwar years.
And another departure other than era is the sex and sexuality of the protagonist. This is your first novel without lesbian themes.
Well, it is, yes. And I was kind of conscious of that when I started the book, because obviously I've become known, and I've made myself known as a lesbian writer. You know, it's always been very important to me to tell those kinds of stories. But with The Little Stranger, I just felt very early on that it wasn't going to be a lesbian novel, but I still wanted to write it. It's a pretty gothic novel, you know, and I've always been a fan of the gothic. So it was a very appealing prospect for me in lots of ways. But yes, I think it's my readers, actually, or some of my readers have perhaps noticed the lack of lesbian element more than I have. Because, you know, as writing processes are very similar, I think, whatever you're writing about, it's a question of getting to know your characters, figuring out their stories. And really, you know, my experience of writing this book wasn't that different, really, from any of the others.
Now, you dipped your toe in gothic fiction with Affinity, but this is really diving in and getting into spooks and poltergeists. Did you enjoy writing this one?
I did. I loved it, actually. As I said, I've always been drawn to the gothic, and as a kid, I think all my reading was ghost and horror stories. I watched a lot of horror films, spooky films, and I still like a good, you know, intelligent, spooky film. So this, to write The Little Stranger and try and do a story that was genuinely creepy, but also, you know, hopefully had a sort of bit of an intellectual agenda to it as well, was a real challenge, but a real treat too. I really did enjoy writing those scenes where I hope to, you know, slightly scare my reader a little bit.
Now, I think audiobook listeners caught on to the fact that this was a change in direction much quicker than print readers, as this is the only book of yours in the Talking Books library read by a male narrator.
Mm.
Was it strange writing the male narrator?
It feels stranger hearing it actually narrated by Simon Vance, because it really does bring it home to me then, you know, that this is a very male presence. And of course I was aware of the gender difference when I started writing. I have had male characters before, but all my narrators have been female. So suddenly to be sort of inside a male perspective, as it were, you know, I was aware of some of the issues that might arise. But actually, again, it was It's funny, just because my other narrators have been female doesn't necessarily mean they're like me. You know, you still have to, as a writer, you still have to do this imaginative work to get yourself into somebody else's perspective. So with Dr. Faraday, I think his maleness just became one facet of his personality that I had to figure out, you know.
And going from the Victorian era to the 1940s, do you think you'd ever write a contemporary novel?
Yeah, maybe. I used to say no, because my way into writing historical fiction was through the past. It was my interest in the genre, in historical novels, that got me writing them myself. And each of my novels has kind of led to the one next. So there's been this very organic progression to them. But they've all remained very much in the past. And it's the past that inspires me. But I'm interested in stories too, and storytelling. And it may well be that either that one day a story will spring to mind that is very obviously a contemporary story that needs a contemporary setting, or else, as when I made the shift from the Victorian period to the 1940s, you know, I might decide that now is a good moment to do something quite different, to take on a new challenge and, you know, move into the contemporary world to see what kind of novel that produces for me. So yeah, I can see that it's becoming more attractive to me actually as time goes on. But having said that, probably not for the next book, or perhaps even for the one after. But it's a nice thought, it might be there somewhere in the future.
Rod was watching me. He wiped his face, then made a ball of his handkerchief and worked it with his fingers and said, "You wanted to know? I warned you what a filthy thing it was." I cleared my throat. "I'm very glad you told me."
"You are?"
"Of course. I only wish you'd done it sooner. It breaks my heart to think of you having gone through this alone, Rod."
"I had to, you see, for the sake of the family."
"Yes, I see that."
"And you don't judge me too badly over the girl? I swear to God, if I had known..."
"No, no. No one could blame you for that. There's just one thing I'd like to do now. I'd like to examine you, if I may."
"Examine me? Why?"
"I think you're pretty tired, aren't you?"
"Tired? God, I'm out on my feet. I hardly dare close my eyes at night. I'm frightened this thing will return if I do."
Simon Vance reading the audio version of The Little Stranger by Sarah Waters. And Sarah, thanks so much for joining me.
Pleasure, thank you.
All of Sarah's novels are available commercially or in the RNIB Talking Books Library, including The Paying Guests, narrated by Juliet Stevenson. For more information on books in the library and how to join, you can call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 or head to the website rnib.org.uk/library. The current times can be especially challenging for people with sight loss.
For dedicated advice, support, or to access our free talking books and reading services, call RNIB's helpline on 0303 123 9999.
The helpline's open 8 till 8 on weekdays and Saturdays from 9 till 1.
Standing with you through every challenge. RNIB. See differently.
This is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Sabah Salman to hear the books of her life, with so many parents and children working and studying from home, it can be difficult to find room for downtime. But here's something for our listeners in the middle grade years and their families that's both educational and a cracking adventure.
Caroline Lawrence is the award-winning author of The Roman Mysteries, which attracted a huge international following. Now she's back with a new series, The Time Travel Diaries, the second of which is out now. She joined me down the line to tell me more. Caroline, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So for those who haven't yet encountered the Time Travel Diaries, tell us a little bit about them.
I essentially write books because no one has invented a time machine. I want to go back to the past. And the closest we can get is through books. So I've written over 30 historical novels set in the ancient world, which I'm kind of obsessed with, ancient Greece and ancient Rome especially. But it wasn't until like 2 years ago that I finally thought, I'm going to bite the time travel bullet and actually write some books where a kid goes back to ancient times and I can describe the sights, but also the sounds and the smell and the touch and the taste of the ancient world.
Dina and I moved among the treasures in the Temple of Athena, looking for clothes. After only a few minutes, he set the lamp down on a small marble-topped table and picked up something like a crinkly sleeveless T-shirt. "Eureka!" he cried, and then, "Wait, is this for girls or boys?" "I think it's called a chiton," I said. "Boys wore them." He gave it a sniff, nodded happily, and pulled it over his head. "What about me?" I said. "Do you see anything there for me?" "Here." He reached into the gloom and handed me a similar one, only longer. "I think this is a girl's dress," I muttered. "But I'll put it on until we find something better."
Simon Scarterfield, narrating Adventure in Athens, written by my guest, Caroline Lawrence.
And it really does flag up how different the ancient world was to our own. Alex is a contemporary boy from London.
That's right. My hero is Alex, who's a 12-year-old London schoolboy, and he does Latin club at lunch, and his father was Greek, so he speaks modern Greek as well as English. So for that reason, because he knows a bit of Latin and a bit of Greek, an eccentric bazillionaire sends him back to Roman London to find a blue-eyed girl with an ivory knife, whose bones we really did find in Southwark near Shakespeare's Globe from a Roman-level graveyard. And like me, the eccentric bazillionaire, whose name is Solomon Daisy, is a bit obsessed with her. So for various reasons, adults can't go back in time, but kids can. So he sends Alex back.
And in that first time travel diary, he has quite an adventure. It gets a bit gruesome in places, and he and his sidekick Dinu actually swear they are never ever going to time travel again.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I wrote the first book as a standalone. I thought, you know, I'll just write they go back once and it's so awful. You might want to go to ancient Rome, maybe, or Pompeii or Sorrento in Italy, but you would not want to go back to ancient Londinium. And in fact, the original title of the book was going to be Ways to Die in Londinium, because there's so many ways you can die. And then my publisher said, well, go on and write another one. And I'm, okay, I'll write Ways to Die in Ancient Athens. But we decided not to go with that slightly disturbing title. But Alex and his sidekick, Dinu, get lured to go back to ancient Athens to find the wisest man who ever lived. And I don't know how many of your listeners might know who that is, but if you guessed Socrates, pat yourself on the back. He was an ancient Athenian philosopher, and he's famous for saying, I know nothing. That's what makes him wiser than everybody else, because everyone else thinks they know something, but he's the only one who knows that he knows nothing. He is therefore the wisest man in the world.
Now, ancient Athens is not a place that has been visited very often by children's authors in the past. Rome is a little bit more commonly visited. What was it about Athens that really attracted you to write about it?
That's a great question. The book that changed my life, be careful what you read, kids, a book could change your life, was called The Last of the Wine. And it was a book set in ancient Athens during the time of Socrates, Plato, Xenophon. And I read it when I was 18 and I got obsessed with ancient Greece. And I'd always liked the Greek gods, but that book was like a time machine. It transported me back. So I got obsessed with ancient Greece. I studied ancient Greek at university and they said, oh, you have to do Latin too, two dead languages. We call it classics. So I did, first I loved the Greeks more and then I discovered the Romans are even cooler. But this one, I kind of go back to my roots. I think Athens would have been an amazing place to go in the 5th century BC. That's about in the 400s BC. That's like 2,500 years ago. It was hardly bigger than a village, but it produced some of the greatest statesmen, architects, philosophers, playwrights that have ever lived. It was like this amazing golden age when all these amazing people lived. And of course, the most famous in my mind was Socrates. So I thought I'd go back, and I wondered, would it be as grungy as Roman London, which I describe as having streets that are like mud studded with gravel and stuff like that. Of course, if you've been to Athens, you know it's beautifully hot and bright, blue skies. So I went to Athens again, I've been a few times, and tried to imagine not just the sights, but the sounds and the smells of the ancient agora, the ancient marketplace. And in fact, there's this wonderful ancient account that says you can buy anything in the ancient agora. You can buy birds, you can buy fruit, you can buy a witness for your trial to testify on your behalf. So it was just a jumble of people and things. And you might have heard like the shouts of stall keepers, like you can still hear on some of the streets of London, and roving snack sellers who'd walk around with trays of bread. And you might hear the twittering of birds in the bird market, and you might hear the barking of dogs, and you might hear, here's a great sound of ancient Greece, which is the clink of a cowbell or a sheep bell, that each one had a different sound. So your shepherd, as he comes through ancient Athens, you'd hear the clink of his bells, and you might even hear the sound of a bull being sacrificed, or the bleat of a goat before its throat is cut, because of course they sacrificed animals to their gods.
My children were huge fans of the Roman mysteries, and something that really struck me from one of the books was that you said that every story starts with an object for you. Was there a particular object that inspired this book?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, the Roman mysteries were inspired by both the archaeology, but also the primary sources, the things written by ancient Romans. And that's one of the best things about reading Greek and Latin is, yes, they're dead languages, but once you read them, you're in the head of someone who lived 2,000 years ago. And one of my characters, Lupus, the boy with no tongue, is inspired by a little two-line poem by a poet called Martial, who talks about an owner who cut out his slave's tongue so that he couldn't testify against him. And so I get ideas from the primary sources, from the artifacts. For this book, it wasn't so much artifacts, it was more the primary sources. It was reading Plato's dialogues, which did my head in, I have to say, because Plato's like one of the biggest brains, probably one of the biggest geniuses of humanity, along there with Shakespeare and Mozart. And he wrote about Socrates, who Socrates himself, the wisest man who ever lived, never wrote a word, as far as we know. Maybe he wrote one little line of poetry, but it was mainly down to his disciple, his student Plato, who made him famous. And he discusses how a person should live in the world and what a good life is. And so Socrates was really the spur for my curiosity. And he was famously ugly. He had a snub nose and big fat lips and bug eyes, and he was bald. And people likened him to a satyr. If you know about Greek mythology, those are those creatures with goat ears and goat legs, and they drink wine a lot. And I had a revelation that Socrates would have looked a bit like Santa Claus in a tablecloth. If you could imagine Santa Claus, if he'd been working out on the beach for about 2 years, and he was all brown and tanned and muscular, and then put him in a tablecloth with a walking stick, that's what Socrates would have looked like. So Socrates was my inspiration. I wanted to know why people have been writing about him for 2,000 years and try to get a grip on who he was.
And I know that you have had fan letters from children around the world who have been inspired to study Latin, having read your Roman mysteries. Are you hoping to inspire a similar renewal of worldwide interest in ancient Greece?
Absolutely, yeah, because it is so much fun to read dead languages, because like I said, it's like a giant code or puzzle. And reading ancient Greek, you can really impress your friends at a party. You can, for example, quote the beginning of Homer's Iliad about the anger of Achilles, menena edetea peleado achilleos, and people will be very impressed if you can quote some ancient Greek. And also, it's a different alphabet, and it looks really cool. It's alpha, beta, gamma. And when you first look at it, it looks like little black worms crawling on white. But then when you can read it, you actually can see pictures. And you can actually hear it being read. And if you know modern Greek, if you can understand modern Greek, you might understand a bit of ancient Greek as well. So yeah, I love dead languages. I also do Hebrew as well. So I can do Hebrew, Latin, and Greek, and they take me back to the past.
Those are the differences, but I think one of the things that has really struck me is just how little human beings have changed.
This is probably the most compelling aspect of the study of classics, the ancient world, is how much like us they were, even though they lived so long ago. And you'll be reading along or something or listening to something being read and think, yeah, they were like us. Yeah, they were like us. And then suddenly, bam, something hits you and you think, no, they weren't like us. And so it's this tension of how they were like us. Of course, everyone wants to be fed and clothed and have a comfortable, happy life. But this is, again, what Socrates talks about, is what is a good life? And way back then, everyone thought money and fame was the best thing. And Socrates says, no, the most important thing in life, spoiler alert, is curating, taking care of your soul, the eternal part of you, and doing what's right. And this is amazing because he lived like 500 years before Jesus Christ, who has many of the same ideas. It's fascinating, that tension. And that's why I've been studying classics for 40 years and will never get bored or tired of it, because it throws a light on our own world.
Now, much of Greek storytelling was in the oral tradition, and it's something that strikes me very much as I listen to audiobooks for my stories, that oral tradition continues 2,500 years later. And I know many of your books have been made into audiobooks.
Yeah, and I love audiobooks. In fact, although I can read the Iliad in Greek, I love to hear it being read, because as you say, that's the way it started. It was a bard, a storyteller, telling a story after dinner, maybe plucking a stringed instrument in between a little bit. But that ability to hear the story, hear the words come in and make the smells and the sounds and the images in your head. So I love listening to audiobooks, and I love listening to my own audiobooks. In fact, they've done the first one, the first time travel diaries read by Simon Skardefeld. And I've just been walking around listening to it, and I really enjoy it. I think, did I write that? Yeah, that's quite good. I like that. So yeah, audiobooks are fantastic. And I'm really so happy that they're going to be doing a version of Adventure in Athens. And I'll have to coach Simon Skardefeld a little bit, because there's some Greek phrases like "uden oida," which means I know nothing.
While we wait for Simon to be able to return to a studio, you've very kindly offered to read an extract exclusively for the Read On listeners.
Exclusively for you. And as I said earlier, the reason I want to go back in time is the sight, the sound, the smell, the taste, all that sensory stuff. So when Alex gets to Athens, he's trying to find Socrates, who's supposed to be speaking in the Agora, the ancient market. And I have a chapter called Smelly Agora. And I'll just read you a little bit. And as I read it, see if you can imagine the smells that Alex would smell. Maybe it was because the blazing sun magnified all the odors, but the moment we entered the Agora, I encountered a symphony of smells. The sickly sweet whiff of sewage from the drain behind us formed a bass note. Next came the rhythmic pong of sausage sellers roasting their ancient hot dogs on portable clay barbecues. Then the churchy melody of incense drifting from shrines under their sacred trees. Rising above it all was a chorus of smells coming from the men around us. Rank sweat, stale urine, bad breath, and perfumed beard oil.
Fantastic.
So I love the idea that smells can actually be like a symphony of sounds, because you're getting a kind of synesthesia, which is when you confuse the senses a little bit and you can see the notes as different colors and you can smell the sounds and hear the smells. And as I said, it's the closest thing to going back in a time machine, and it's much safer than going back in a time machine too.
And while we're all stuck at home, have you been able to start work on the third book in the series?
Yeah, I am. In the time travel diaries to Athens, they go back when Socrates is in his like 40s, and they meet this like 9-year-old kid who likes to pick his nose, and they discover he's Plato, but he's kid Plato. So he's like gonna grow up to be a genius, but at the moment he's got his finger up his nose half the time. And that gave me the idea, what if you could go back and meet kid Jesus, or maybe teen Jesus? Like, what would Jesus have been like when he was an adolescent? You know, would he have been grumpy and moody? So because I speak Hebrew as well as Greek and Latin, I thought, let's go to ancient Israel for our final trip, maybe. And he can see if he can find Jesus Christ when he was a kid. Of course, his name would have been Yeshua, which is the Aramaic for Jesus. And that can be really fun because ancient Israel doesn't just have Hebrew, but it has the Roman soldiers who speak Latin and then Greek culture. So Greek was the lingua franca in the first century AD. So you'd have all my languages, and I'm having so much fun researching that book.
Well, Caroline Lawrence, thank you so much for taking us back to ancient Greece for a few minutes. I know lots of people are going to enjoy Adventure in Athens, and I hope you'll come back to tell us about teenage Jesus.
Thank you, Red, and stay safe.
Adventure in Athens by Caroline Lawrence is available from the RNIB Library, as are her Roman mysteries.
Now it's back to Sabah Salman for the books of her life.
Sabah, was there a book that you read as a young person that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
I think the book that really made an impression on me as a child, that made me fall in love with reading and writing and stories, was Little Women by Louisa May Alcott. It just has this enduring appeal. And I think it was the first book I'd read at that age. I would have been sort of 12 or 13, where all the protagonists were women. Also, I was old enough to know that, you know, this was an author writing about independent women or young girls and women at a time when not many people were doing that. And the fact that it was about finding your place in the world, your identity, and what is possible within the restrictions that society places on you, that really struck a chord with me. It's got a great story, and I like the way that you can interpret the title in two ways. So Little Women in terms of young women, but also, are we talking about women that are seen as little, as somehow inferior? And I think that reflects the patronising attitudes of the time. So that's the book I would choose as the one that, yeah, influenced me and made a big impression on me when I was younger.
Three chairs were arranged in a row before a table, on which was a lamp. Also, four white badges with a big PC in different colours on each, and the weekly newspaper called the Pickwick Portfolio, to which all contributed something, while Joe, who revelled in pens and ink, was the editor. At 7 o'clock, the four members ascended to the club room, tied their badges round their heads, and took their seats with great solemnity. Meg, as the eldest, was Samuel Pickwick. Joe, being of a literary turn, Augustus Snodgrass. Beth, because she was round and rosy, Tracy Tupman. And Amy, who was always trying to do what she couldn't, was Nathaniel Winkle.
Liza Ross, narrating Little Women by Louisa May Alcott, which is available from the RNIB Library. And is there a book that you'd like to curl up with and reread on a rainy day?
Well, I think there are many, but the one that really springs to mind is Joanna Cannon's The Trouble with Goats and Sheep. It's such a joyful, funny read, and it's a real page-turner. As a child who grew up in the 70s, I really related to the sort of long hot summers and references to Angel Delight and Jackie magazine, all these things from my girlhood, as well as living in a suburban town with neighbours twitching their curtains. And the fact that it's written from the perspective of a child as well, from the perspective of children, it's just really beautifully written, and it's driven by mystery. Everyone seems to be hiding a secret. So I think probably the journalist in me as well was really drawn, or is really drawn, to that sense of what's going on. We need to ask questions about this. So yeah, and it makes you think about the secret life of your neighbourhoods. We all love that, don't we? So I think it's a brilliant book.
What do you mean, Jesus? May Roper pulled the crocheted C a little further up her legs. On the drainpipe! I've seen him with my own eyes! Have you been in the sun again, Brian? Sheila Dakin thinks it's a sign. A sign she's been at the sherry. Brian turned back to the window. There was quite a crowd now, and he could see Harold Forbes, marching around in the middle of it all in his shorts. Everyone's out there, ma'am. They reckon it's something to do with Margaret Creasy going missing. You don't need to be Jesus to work out what's happened there. You've only got to look at number 11. Brian frowned but said nothing. They reckon the vicar from St. Anthony's is coming later, he said. The vicar? Maybe even a bishop, you know, to give it the green light, as a miracle.
Paula Wilcox, narrating The Trouble with Goats and Sheep by Joanna Cannon, which is available from the RNIB Library. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yeah, so I would like to share Margaret Atwood's Hagseed. Now, this obviously isn't the most recent novel from Margaret Atwood, who I love, but I didn't read it when it came out. So I was a bit dubious because it's a retelling of Shakespeare's The Tempest, and I wasn't sure. I was a bit suspicious of it. But I have to say, it's absolutely amazing. It's funny. It's a sort of poignant reinvention of the play. And the central character, Felix, is just mesmerising. I had this love-hate relationship with him throughout the book. But it's got great characters, great voices, and I just ripped through it. So I would definitely recommend that.
It didn't take Felix long to discover that it was easy to disappear, and that his disappearance was borne lightly by the world at large. The hole his sudden absence left in the fabric of the Makeshereg Festival was filled soon enough, filled indeed by Tony. The show rolled on, as shows do. Where had Felix gone? It was a mystery, but not one that anyone appeared dedicated to solving. He could imagine the chit-chat. Maybe he'd had a breakdown, jumped off a bridge. The intensity of his sorrow when his little girl had died, so tragic. And then the way he immediately became obsessed over that frankly crack-brained tempest of his, you had to wonder.
R.H. Thompson, narrating Hagseed by Margaret Atwood, which is available from the RNIB Library. Well, Sabah Saman, thank you so much for sharing your obvious passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you so much, Red, for having me on. I've really enjoyed speaking to you.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at RedSail, which is RedSell, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.